Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bad Things, The Nature and Normative Role of Harm, by Neil Feit, narrated by Gabriel Vaughan. Introduction. In this book, I construct, defend, and apply a certain account of the nature of harm. To the extent that we have an ordinary, practical concept of harm, my focus is on this concept. A person would ordinarily be harmed, for example, if she were to undergo being killed, being beaten or tortured, falling down a flight of stairs, having a heart attack, being choked, being imprisoned or incarcerated, having her property stolen, being struck by lightning, having an arm or leg broken, being subjected to verbal abuse, being passed over for promotion at work, and being infected with a contagious illness. Some, but not all, of the situations described here would typically include an unjust or wrong action on the part of some person or other. The list is not intended to be exhaustive, of course. The idea is merely to give the listener a number of clear and uncontroversial cases of harm. We might also imagine a different collection of situations in which a person would ordinarily be benefited by the occurrence of a given event. The account of harm that I will defend is a specific version of a widely held, but also widely criticized, perspective on the nature of harm. The general perspective is most commonly known as the counterfactual comparative account of harm, or CCA. Consider, for example, the case of falling down a flight of stairs from the list of situations previously mentioned. Here, something happens, an event of falling, that harms the person who falls. According to the counterfactual comparative account, this event harms the one who falls, given that she would have been better off if she had not fallen. There is an analogous account for beneficial events. According to this account, which I likewise defend, an event benefits a given person provided that she would have been worse off if it had not occurred. The counterfactual comparative account has sometimes been offered as an account of a certain kind of value, that is, of the conditions under which things are good or bad for us in a certain way. In ordinary circumstances, for example, receiving a large sum of money would be good for you, whereas falling down a flight of stairs would be bad. More generally, an event is good for a person provided that it makes her better off, in the sense that she would have been worse off had it not occurred. And an event is bad for a person provided that she would have been better off had it not occurred. I think that both accounts are correct. That is, I take harmful events to be bad in a certain way for the one who is harmed, beneficial ones to be good for the one who is benefited, and harm and benefit to be opposite ends of this effect on an individual continuum. My discussions throughout the book will largely be in terms of harm and benefit, although I will sometimes use the associated value terms interchangeably. So, the things that harm us make us worse off than we would otherwise have been without them. Sometimes this is because they put us into states, like pain, that are intrinsically bad for us. On the aforementioned list, for example, falling down the stairs and being choked are typically harms of this sort. But sometimes this is because they take good things away from us, by preventing us from being in states that are intrinsically good for us. With respect to this list, being passed over for promotion might be a harm of this sort. These are not mutually exclusive, of course. For example, some things that happen can cause us to be in intrinsically bad states and also prevent us from being in good ones. The counterfactual comparative account, I will argue, provides a unified treatment of all of these harms. I have thus far spoken about people as those who might suffer harm, but it is clear that many non-human animals can be harmed as well. Sometimes, however, We talk of harm to things such as personal property, businesses, the planet, and so on. Whether or not such things can be harmed depends on whether or not they can be made better or worse off. I accept the widely held view that this, in turn, depends on whether they have welfare levels, or levels of well-being, that are capable of rising or falling. Roughly speaking, a harm is something that interferes with or obstructs one's well-being. Those who think of harm as a setback to someone's interests and take interests to be distinct from well-being may think of being worse off in terms of the relevant interests. Not much will turn on this, but it seems clear that harm is a matter of one's well-being being interfered with in a certain way. As Victor Tadros puts it, well-being provides the currency of harm. Our automobiles and dining tables, for example, pretty clearly do not have levels of well-being that can be influenced by the course of events in the world. So, our talk of such objects being harmed must be taken to be loose or metaphorical talk. I will try to remain neutral with respect to competing accounts of the nature of well-being. For example, while I think that plants cannot strictly be harmed, nothing in the account that I defend commits me to this view. If you think that plants have a minimal level of well-being that can fall with damage and rise with healthy growth, for example, you may believe that plants can be harmed. Our disagreement will be about the components of well-being, but it need not be about the correct theory of harm. In his terrific and influential paper, Doing Away with Harm, Ben Bradley proposes a list of 7 desiderata for an account of harm. It will be helpful to consider them here. Bradley focuses on what he calls extrinsic overall harm. For example, a surgeon might cut and damage a patient's skin in order to perform a certain operation. The surgeon's act harms the patient, but it is not an overall harm. It is a pro tanto harm that, assuming the operation goes well, benefits the patient, all things considered. In ordinary circumstances, by way of contrast, falling down a flight of stairs would be an overall harm, or harmful all things considered, since it has no beneficial features. Something counts as an extrinsic harm, roughly, when it is harmful in virtue of what it brings about rather than any of its intrinsic properties. I will return to these notions in the first 2 chapters. For now, I will note that Bradley's list, with one exception, seems appropriate for any kind of harm. The first item on Bradley's list is extensional adequacy, according to which the analysis must fit the data. A lack of counterexamples is obviously desirable. An account of harm should not imply, for example, that there is no harm when intuitively there is, or that there is harm when intuitively there is not. An extensionally adequate account should also allow for harms of different magnitudes. The second desideratum is axiological neutrality. The analysis should not presuppose the truth of any specific account of well-being. This item seems inappropriate for the analysis of intrinsic harms or events that are in themselves harmful for a given person. I will return to this in Chapter 1. The third is ontological neutrality. In addition to harmful actions performed by people, an adequate account must allow for other harmful events, such as the behavior of non-human animals and natural disasters, like hurricanes, and also for different sorts of beings to be the subjects of harm. Fourth, the analysis should not presuppose that harming is morally wrong or involves vicious intent. As Bradley notes, this condition, amorality, follows from ontological neutrality, since impersonal events can harm individuals in the same way that our actions can. The fifth condition is unity. The analysis should not consist merely in a list of harmful things, but should explain what all harms have in common by locating a common core to harm. These five desiderata seem very plausible, especially if we take them, as Bradley does, to be defeasible conditions. The last two items might be somewhat more controversial as desiderata for an adequate account of harm, but they are prima facie plausible conditions as well. The sixth one is prudential importance. Bradley claims that an adequate account should entail that harm is something worth caring about in prudential deliberation. For instance, that harm is the sort of thing we should try to avoid. Finally, we have normative importance. Bradley's idea here is that an acceptable account should entail that harm is the sort of thing that it makes sense for there to be deontological restrictions about. There might be some tension here with amorality, depending on how exactly we construe it. It does seem plausible, however, that there are moral reasons not to act in a way that will harm others, and that these would be among the deontological restrictions that Bradley has in mind. For some discussion of these issues, see Rabenberg 2014, 2. Later in the book, especially in chapters 5 and 6, I will discuss some issues related to the prudential and normative importance of harm. For now, I will provisionally accept the legitimacy of these two desiderata, at least if we interpret them charitably. Even if Bradley's list is not exhaustive, the desiderata are prima facie desirable features of an account of harm, and they will help to put the target concept in focus. In the rest of this introduction, I will provide an overview of the book's seven chapters. In chapter one, I consider some varieties of harm with the intention of setting the stage for the rest of the book. I discuss the distinction between intrinsic harm and extrinsic harm. I also discuss the distinction between pro tanto harm and overall harm, or harm all things considered. Next, I turn to a preliminary consideration of a basic version of the counterfactual comparative account of harm and benefit, and I evaluate the account in light of the desiderata just discussed. Finally, I discuss the notion of harm at a time and preview some issues concerning the harm of death. Chapter 2 contains a more detailed discussion of the counterfactual comparative account. I formulate a general version of the account for all things considered harm, and also a version that accounts for harm at a time. Next, I once again examine the idea of pro tanto harm and consider how advocates of the counterfactual comparative account should treat it. I then consider some objections to the general account and offer responses to the ones that do not seem very serious. The chapters to follow will focus on the more serious objections and issues that relate to them. Finally, I consider several accounts of harm that compete with the counterfactual comparative account. My goal throughout the book is to defend and extend the counterfactual comparative account rather than to provide detailed discussion and criticism of competing accounts of harm. But here I discuss what I take to be the most substantial challenges for the competing views. In Chapter 3, I discuss what I take to be the most significant challenge to the counterfactual comparative account. This is the challenge of certain cases of preemption and overdetermination. Suppose, for example, that Bob breaks my kneecap, but also that if Bob had not done this, then Peter would have injured me in the same way at the same time. The account seems to imply that Bob's act does not harm me, since I would not have been any better off if he had not performed it. I briefly discuss the problem and then sketch a solution that I call the plural harm approach. Roughly, the idea is that Bob and Peter together harm me, even though neither of them harms me on his own. In Fight 2015, I defended an account that incorporated a certain principle of plural harm. The account that I defend in this book is similar in some respects, but it is substantially different and more detailed. I discuss the plural harm approach and illustrate some of its features, but I postpone a detailed discussion until Chapter 4. I finish Chapter 3 with a critical discussion of some other approaches to the problem of preemption, approaches that have been proposed by those who also favor the perspective of the counterfactual comparative account. I conclude that an adequate account of harm should allow for plural harm in addition to harm inflicted by individual events. In Chapter 4, I return to the plural harm approach and defend a detailed account of harm that I call CCA with plural harm, which provides necessary and sufficient conditions for any given individual's being harmed by one or more events. This account entails, but is not entailed by, the counterfactual comparative account discussed previously. Correct and illuminating equivalencies of this kind are, to put it mildly, difficult to find. Accordingly, I am happy to take the view that CCA with plural harm is a very good approximation to the truth, or close enough. I begin by discussing how it can be the case that some events harm a given individual, even if none of those events individually is harmful. I then proceed to extend the basic view so that it accounts for the amount or degree of harm inflicted by an event or events, and also for the times at which, or during which, harmful events are harmful. I conclude the chapter by summing up the discussion and presenting the account of overall and all things considered harm that I believe to be correct. Chapter 5 focuses on the plural harm approach as it relates to several issues concerning the metaphysics and moral relevance of harm. I begin by considering a recent argument against the counterfactual comparative account given by Erik Carlson, Jens Johansson, and Olli Risberg. I argue that CCA with plural harm lets advocates of CCA respond plausibly to their objection. In the next two sections, I consider and respond to some objections that focus on the plural harm approach itself. Finally, in the last section, I respond to a challenge for the plural harm approach that concerns the moral status of actions performed in cases of preemption, such as Bob's act of breaking my kneecap in the example discussed earlier. Cases of preemption raise a complaint about the extensional adequacy of the counterfactual comparative account. According to the complaint, the account undergenerates harm since it fails to count certain harmful events, like Bob's breaking my kneecap, as harmful. Another complaint about extensional adequacy goes in the opposite direction, and it is the subject of Chapter 6. The complaint is that the account overgenerates harm, since it counts as harmful certain events that seem to be mere failures to benefit, and hence not harmful. For example, it seems to imply that when one person fails to benefit another, the first person thereby harms the second, since the second one would have been better off if the first had benefited her. Many philosophers claim that there is a serious challenge for the counterfactual comparative account here. I begin by discussing the challenge. After surveying some solutions that I think are instructive but inadequate, I defend my own solution. I argue that there are good reasons to admit a certain range of cases where one person harms another by failing to benefit her. In a nutshell, the cases in question are cases of preventative harm. In the last section of the chapter, I consider the impact of my solution on the widely held belief that harming people is worse than merely failing to benefit them, and I defend a position on the strength of moral reasons against harming. In the final chapter, I return to the harm of death. The issues here, like those in the previous chapter, are largely distinct from issues concerning plural harm. As I present CCA with plural harm in Chapter 4, events are harmful, all things considered, only if they are harmful at certain times. I consider ways to abandon this commitment, both in Chapter 4 and here in Chapter 7. Here, my main goal is to defend the view that in cases where death does in fact harm the one who dies, it harms him after he has died. I begin by discussing the problem of locating the times at which death harms the one who dies. I then defend a solution which implies that the deceased have a neutral welfare level, that is, a well-being level of zero. Since this view is controversial, I also discuss some backup plans, according to which the dead have no level of well-being at all. After discussing several objections to the view that I favor and offering replies, I conclude with a discussion of some issues concerning the harm of death and the evaluation of counterfactuals. 1. Varieties of harm. Harm is connected, in one way or another, with well-being. The things that harm us make our lives go worse or make us fare badly in some way. In this chapter, I consider some varieties of harm and set the stage for the rest of the book. Although I will focus on harm, there will be a corresponding claim about benefit for each claim about harm. Being on the opposite side of the effect on well-being continuum, benefit is also closely connected with well-being. Things that benefit us make our lives go better or make us fare well. In order to be as neutral as I can be, I will have relatively little to say about the nature of well-being itself. From time to time, and especially for illustrative purposes, I will assume that pleasure is a component of well-being that is intrinsically good for us, and that pain is a component of well-being that is intrinsically bad for us. For such purposes, I will sometimes assume that these are the only components of well-being, that is, that hedonism is true. For what it is worth, I am inclined to think that some version of hedonism really is true. But the claims about harm that I will defend, and especially the account developed in Chapter 4, do not require or rule out any theory of well-being. 1.1. Intrinsic and extrinsic harm. There is a distinction between things that have intrinsic value for us, that is, things that are good or bad for us in themselves, and things that have extrinsic value for us. This distinction, or a similar one, is sometimes made with respect to harm. For example, according to Ben Bradley, to say that something is intrinsically harmful is just to say that it is intrinsically bad for the person undergoing it. It is to make a claim about well-being. On the other hand, something would be an extrinsic harm for a person if it harms her but is not intrinsically bad for her. Sometimes the distinction is made in terms of events. An event is an intrinsic harm for a person when, and to the extent that, it harms her in virtue of its intrinsic properties. So, if the intrinsic properties of a given event, for example, my experiencing pain, entail that I am in a state that is intrinsically bad for me, then the event is an intrinsic harm for me. However, the most important and interesting cases of harm are not cases of intrinsic harm. They are cases in which events harm people at least partly in virtue of the effects that they have on those people, and not because of their intrinsic properties. This is extrinsic harm. When we think about examples of harm, we are inclined to think about things like smoking, physical attacks, theft, stubbing a toe, and the like. None of these things is intrinsically bad for anybody, but they are things about which we do and should care. When something of this sort harms a person, she suffers an extrinsic harm. The clearest cases of extrinsic harm are probably cases of things that cause pain or suffering. The things that harm us in this way, then, must be events. I will try to remain as neutral as possible about the nature of events, but it seems very plausible that they are unrepeatable, concrete particulars that are located in space and time. For example, suppose that Peter punches Simon in the stomach. In this case, the relevant harmful event, that is, the event of Peter's punching Simon, is not intrinsically bad for Simon, although the pain that Simon experiences moments later is. So the punch constitutes an extrinsic harm for Simon. It also makes sense to ask how harmful the punch is for Simon, or how much it harms him. Here, the extent to which the punch is extrinsically harmful for Simon is determined, at least in part, by the intrinsic harm that Simon suffers as a result of it. Some philosophers use the term intrinsic harm in a different way. For example, Justin Klockseim and Duncan Purvis include a comparative element in their ideas of intrinsic harm. As I understand them, they would say that Simon's experiencing pain is intrinsically harmful for him, but not because it is intrinsically bad for him. Instead, as they see it, his experiencing pain is an intrinsic harm because he would have been better off if he had not experienced it. And this is not in virtue of the painful episode's relation to any other events or states. The punch would not be intrinsically harmful for Simon because, although he would have been better off if it had not occurred, this is in virtue of the punch's relations to the other events or states, namely, the pain that Simon experiences. I think it is better to restrict the term intrinsic harm to things that are intrinsically bad for us or events that are harmful purely because of their intrinsic properties. As Klockseim and Purvis see it, I think, a happy person who is not in any intrinsically bad state could nevertheless be suffering intrinsic harm if she would have been better off had some event not occurred. I agree that the relevant event will count as extrinsically harmful, but here it seems to me correct to say that there is extrinsic harm with no intrinsic harm. Moreover, someone who is in an intrinsically bad state, pain, for example, need not be suffering intrinsic harm, as Klockseim and Purvis see it, because she might have been even worse off had some relevant event not occurred. But it seems correct to say that experiences of pain, assuming that pain is intrinsically bad for the one who experiences it, are always intrinsically harmful. I will focus on extrinsic harm with the goal of arriving at a complete and adequate account. The term overall harm is more commonly used for my target, although it is typically used to convey more information about the harm at issue, as will become apparent in the next section, and I will use it. This is because the intrinsic harm or benefit, if any, of an event will factor into the determination of its overall harmfulness. For example, suppose that an event that consists in my experiencing pleasure occurs, but that it has various unpleasant effects on me. Suppose also that I would have been better off, on balance, if the event in question had not occurred. I would not have experienced any pleasure then, but I would have been much better off later, because no unpleasant effects would have occurred. So, the experience of pleasure is intrinsically beneficial for me, but it is overall harmful in virtue of its effects, and the other features, on my view. But the fact that it is an intrinsic benefit makes it less harmful overall, in this particular way. If some other event, which was not itself an intrinsic benefit, had all the same extrinsic features as the experience of pleasure, it would have been more harmful for me overall. Impersonal events, like earthquakes and lightning strikes, are neither intrinsically harmful nor intrinsically beneficial, and so when these events are harms, they are overall harms for their victims purely in virtue of being extrinsically harmful. It is extremely plausible that the same is true of human actions, like punches. All of the examples in this chapter, and throughout the rest of the book, will be cases of these two sorts. 1.2. Pro tanto, overall, and all things considered harm. The term overall harm is commonly used to pick out not only harm that includes intrinsic and extrinsic harm, and benefit in the way just discussed, but also harmfulness, all things considered, in contrast with, say, harmfulness in some respect or another. My usage will align with this, with the
sample complete. Ready to continue?